Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so happy to be with all of you this morning. I have a great show planned for you. My guest will be Laura Shapiro, who is a food historian and author of a wonderful new book called What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. And I can't wait to introduce her to all of you and talk more about food historians and what they do and her book, which is just absolutely wonderful. But first I want to share some things going on in and around the city, some things in the news, and share my weekly recipe with you, of course. So first off, finally, I've been talking about the Shinnecock Labor Powwow for weeks now, months maybe. It's this weekend. And every year, the Shinnecock Nations has a Labor Day powwow, and they open it up to the whole community, and it starts tomorrow, Friday, and it goes all the way through Monday. So check out their website for more information. I have a link on my website as well at iegreen.com. But the Shinnecock Powwow is a great, fun event, so I really highly recommend it. And the weather should be nice and cool most of the weekend, so enjoy. September 9th, Taste Talks in Brooklyn, and this is a festival hosting amazing brunch and a day-long conference in Williamsburg. And that should be an interesting event. Also on that same day, Slow Food North Shore is having their family film event at the Cinema Arts Center. We are screening a documentary called What's on Your Plate? And following that, we will have a vegetarian sushi rolling workshop. And it is $7 for members, $12 for the public for the film, and another $10 if you want to do the workshop sushi rolling. So it should be really great. Love to see you there. There's also a fall potluck the next day on September 10th at Restoration Farm, which is our local organic CSA sustainable farm right here at Bethpage Restoration Village. So if you can make that, that's open to everyone. September 13th, Food Tank is having a summit here in New York. Tickets, it's sold out. However, it will be live screened. So it is taking place at the Green Space in New York City. But you can go onto the Food Tank website and link on and listen live. So that should be really great. September 16th is a Hip Hop for Hunger in the Bronx. Also should be wonderful. That's at the Andrew Friedman Mansion, also known as the Hip Hop Mansion, and that's in the Bronx. There is a National Drive Electric Week event out in Riverhead, and it will be an opportunity to see all the different electrical vehicles that are out on the market all in one place. So that should be really great. Sunday, September 17th. So if you're thinking about getting an electric vehicle, this could be the time to check out all of them under one roof. It will be at the Tanger Outlets out in Riverhead. Also, there is an event on September 21st, Trash Talking, How New York City is Fighting Food Waste, and that's at the Essex Street Market on September 21st from 6:30 to 8. There is an Association of Vertical Farming Summit in D.C. on September 21st through the 23rd at the University of Columbia. All of these events, for more information, you can go to my website and find out about them. There's also the New York City Wine and Food Festival coming up in October, 12th through 17th. And I just can't believe, there's many more events. I'm not going to go into all of them, so just check out my website. But I can't believe that it is the end of summer here. Labor Day is this weekend, and I have to admit, I'm really sad about it. I wait all year for summer because I love being outside. I love my garden. I love the space of being outdoors. You know, my home is very cute and charming, but it's petite. And so in the summer, I just feel like I can breathe. But as I wrote about this week in my blog, and if you don't get my blog, you can sign up for that also on my website. But I talked about focusing in, and I've just been doing so many things all year long, and I have been working on a book that I just can't manage to bring to the front burner. It's been back there on the back burner for years now, and I'm really going to focus on it. So I will be doing less events. I'll still be here with you every week, but I am really going to focus on my radio show and try to move, I don't mean my radio show, focus on my book and try to move that along. So I'm really excited about that. You know, with the administration we have, there is just so many disturbing things that are going on a regular basis. I mean, he's trying to completely undo the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency was set up to create laws to protect us. He's trying to undo the Clean Water Act. You know, of course, we have this horrific event going on in Texas, and he's still talking about the crowds and how many people are there to hear him speak. He's just out of touch with, I'd say, the majority of the people, or maybe it's really just the majority of the people that I know, because it seems like those that voted for him still like him. So we definitely have a big divide here in our country, and we really need to talk about the issues and try to bring us together, whether it's talking about race, talking about anti-Semitism, talking about, you know, sustainable food, talking about all these issues. We need to start the conversations because we are a divided country and we need to bring people together. But we need the departments like the Environmental Protection Agency, and we need the Food and Drug Administration to be protecting us and not big corporations. And everything is just so backwards. There was a great article that I posted in my blog from Civil Eats talking about race in our food system. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is, you know, is an issue, but also when we talk about food and the food movement, we have to really address the fact that our food system has been built on the backs of race and slavery and not paying people what they're worth, et cetera, et cetera. So as we look to purchase healthy, wonderful, sustainable food, know that when you're paying a little bit more, you're paying people that are doing the right thing, and they deserve to be paid the price that they're asking. So that's really important to know. I want to share with you my weekly recipe. This week, it is a peach cobbler because I harvested all the peaches out of my peach tree this week, and I had so many. As I've written about many times, I have a sick peach tree that is still giving me peaches. It has a borer that is has infested it for years now, and I have not been able to get rid of it, so it will eventually probably take it down. And it also has a little bit of a fungus, so the peaches, you have to get them just at the right time before they start going bad from the fungus. So I do a lot of cutting away of the bad parts, and the parts that are delicious, I made lots of peach cobbler. And so this recipe made 3 10-inch pies. And I started by peeling the peaches and cutting them up, and I had 24 cups of peaches. So I'm not going by the numbers of peaches because, like I said, I had to cut around mine. But I did measure, and I had 24 cups of peaches. So that was 8 cups per pie, peeled and sliced. 2 cups of honey, 2 tablespoons lemon juice, 1.5 teaspoons of cinnamon, and 4 tablespoons of organic cornstarch. And with peach pie, because it is so runny, you really do need the cornstarch to help thicken it up. And I didn't want to use flour, of course, because I am keeping these gluten-free and vegan. So I used the organic cornstarch, and works wonderfully. For the crumb topping, I used 3 cups of gluten-free oats, 1/2 cup of gluten-free flour, 1.5 cups of oil, 3 cups of chopped walnuts, or you can use pecans if you prefer, 1 3/4 cups of brown sugar, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, and 1/2 a teaspoon salt. And so for the filling, I just combined all those ingredients in a bowl, and I first greased the pie pans. You can also put it in a casserole pan if you want to make one large one. You can do that too. And then I poured the fruit into 3 well-greased 10-inch pie pans. If you're using 8-inch pie pans, this would probably make 4 pies. And then for the crumb topping, I just combined all the ingredients. I chopped up the walnuts a bit, and I mixed that with all of the ingredients, including the oil. And I used half coconut oil and half safflower oil, but you can use whatever oil you like. And then I put the crumb topping on top, and I baked it at 375 for about 40 minutes until the bubbles start, until the juices start bubbling through the top. If it starts to look like the crumb topping is burning, just put a little aluminum foil or parchment paper on top, and that will prevent it from burning. And that's it. It's really delicious. This is the season for peaches, and there's nothing like delicious peaches. So check out the recipe. As always, I'd love you to let me know what you think. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to all of you. As I said, my guest is Laura Shapiro. She is a food historian and author of the wonderful new book called What She Ate, 6 Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. And we don't often think of food from a historical perspective, nor do we look at food as a lens to tell a story, but Laura Shapiro does. And she does it with eloquence and humor, and I'm so happy to have her with us. She's an award-winning author of 3 other classic culinary history books, has won numerous awards, and is just amazing. She also helped co-curated the widely acclaimed exhibition Lunch Hour NYC, and she worked for 16 years at Newsweek, where she covered food, women's issues, and the arts, and won several journalism awards there as well. Anyway, Laura, are you with me?
I'll be here.
Thank you so much. So first, if you could just share a little bit of your history with us, I'd love to know, how did you get into writing about food history, and when did your passion begin? And was it history, or was it food, or did they just, were both your passions, and you just brought them together?
Well, you know, it really started with writing about women. I was a journalist in the 1970s in the alternative press in Boston, and the women's movement was just picking up and gaining steam in those years, and so I was covering that for the Real paper in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I just followed the women's movement as it began to take shape in those years. And while you do that, you know, you study its past as well. It was a wonderful piece of information to me to learn that we did not invent the women's movement. It had been going on in one way or another for 100 or more years before the 1970s caught up with it. So I had a lot to learn, and I kind of steeped myself in American history, specifically of the history of women. And then when I started thinking about writing a book, I went looking for interesting women, and I came across Fanny Farmer, who was the principal of the Boston Cooking School in 1896 and incredibly influential in the lives of women and in the lives of everyone who's ever stepped into a kitchen at that time. And I started to see that women and cooking were kind of an indissoluble whole entity, and that if you wanted to study women, you really should study them in the kitchen. So that was what got me started writing about food, was coming at it through the history of women.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because it's true. Most chefs and most of the famous chefs happen to be men, and yet most of them say they learned to cook from their mothers. And
yes, that's exactly right. And what you find out, and I'm sure you've seen this a million times, the cooking that women do at home is, of course, unpaid labor, and the cooking that men do out in the world is the cooking that people pay for. So that is a very important elementary distinction.
I know. And it feels very unfair. And with the women's movement, it would just go hand in hand. So it makes so much sense from that perspective as well. And what was the first book that you wrote?
So the first book I wrote came right out of this understanding of Fanny Farmer. It was called Perfection Salad: Women in Cooking at the Turn of the Century. That was the turn of the 20th century, and I studied the change in our cooking and eating habits right around the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, which was the time when all these traditional methods of feeding ourselves, where you take the food that's in season, you take what you can afford, you do what your mother taught you to do, you just turn out these meals the way they were traditionally turned out. All that kind of approach to the kitchen was starting to fade, and in its place was a new, what they thought of as scientific, modern, up-to-date look at the kitchen, where you did everything according to charts and recipes and amounts of nutrients. So the modern world was moving in for better and worse. I mean, it meant that we were going to get, you know, gas and electricity and running water, which was great. It also meant that we were going to step back from having a real tactile sense of food itself, from understanding that broccoli comes out of the ground. It doesn't just appear in front of you as this frozen block of ice from the supermarket. That's when all the things that our current food revolution was rebelling against, all that stuff started to move into place at the turn of the last century. So that's what that book was about. Then I had a book about women and cooking in the 50s, and then a biography of Julia Child. And then this one, which is not about famous women at all, or rather they're famous, but they're not famous for food. That's what I really got interested in with this one.
Good. Well, how did you choose these six women? And let's go through them. There's Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Gurley Brown, Eva Braun, Barbara Pym. Am I saying her last name right, Pym?
Yes.
Dorothy Wordsworth and Rosa Lewis. Now, how did you pick them?
These were women who were all well-known in their time, and some of them, of course, are still famous today. And I picked them because, first of all, I did enough preliminary research to know that they had a relationship with food and that I'd be able to find it. In other words, they had to be well-known, so they will have acquired some kind of document trail. You have to be able to do the reading mm-hmm. and find out the information. So they were well-known for that reason. But apart from that, it's not exactly random, but they were just women who sort of sprang at me from my previous reading. You know, I'd been all these years reading about women and studying women. And, you know, when you do that, you have women kind of in your filing cabinet. You've got folders that you sort of clip out a story, you put it in there. I went back to my filing cabinet, and I saw, for instance, that I remembered I'd been interested in Barbara Pym, who's a British novelist who published in the 50s and 60s. I'd been interested in her for many years because I love her work. And I thought, I thought about the books. They are full of food. She was a great food lover. I knew that this was a great chance to look at a woman who had an active relationship with food, but wasn't famous for it. She was not a world-famous cook. She didn't write a cookbook. She was just a person with a life in the kitchen and a person who ate. So that was really how I put them together. They were interesting women who had some kind of relationship with food that I could get at. And
but these six women had no relationship with each other or a common thread other than food.
Well,
we all eat.
Right. And that was really the point. What I wanted to say was you don't have to have written a cookbook. You don't have to be Julia Child. You don't have to be a culinary professional to have a relationship with food. And that, in fact, I think some of the most interesting relationships with food show up when people profess not to be interested, when they stand up from the table and basically forget what they ate, when they don't cook. That doesn't mean they aren't relating to the food. It means they're thinking about it in another way, or it plays a different role in their lives. That's what I wanted to get at. You know, I had written mm-hmm. about, you know, people like Julia, whose food life was right up front and important and fascinating. Now I wanted to get to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. You know, you touched on this before, how, you know, it used to be women had to spend all day to prepare food. I mean, they really needed to live in the kitchen because, you know, if you wanted butter, you needed to churn your butter. If you wanted milk, you needed to go milk the cow. You know, I mean, it was just, or, you know, find someone who did, you know. you just really had to put all of your energy into getting a meal on the table. And then you have, you know, someone else that, you know, can live on Jell-O. And it's just amazing, the contrast.
Yes,
you want to talk a little bit about Dorothy Wordsworth? I think, you know, most people don't know her. And I just found, you know, and she's, you know, a real locivore. So,
well, she really
you know, it's
is.
It's
just
incredible to read about her and, you know, see how you know, everything came from her garden compared to, you know, some of the more current women.
Exactly. And, of course, it was a time, this is the very beginning of the 19th century, when everybody was a locavore. I mean, that's what you did. And she lived in a small, in a village in the Lake District, this beautiful area of England, and you ate what was around you. That was what you did. And maybe your neighbor brought over a bushel of gooseberries, or her brother William, the poet, William Wordsworth, he would go and fish in the lake and bring home the fish. That's really about as far away as most of the food came from. They had a big garden. They grew all kinds of things. She would, you know, take the apple off the tree and pull the peas out of the ground. So they ate this this beautiful, very intimate, very hands-on daily diet, and she wrote about it in this this diary she kept, which was published and is beloved now and read very widely. That's the Grasmere Journal, and she just talks in this very simple but beautiful way about how she gathers the food and prepares these very simple meals for herself and her brother. And what you see is just how much she loves him and how much he is the focus of all her kind of her dreams for herself and for their future. What happens in her life is that he gets married to a very dear family friend, and Dorothy's life changes quite a bit after that. And I talk about that, and the food changes also. So when you look at the food, you're seeing a whole shift in the life of somebody who went from a devoted focus on her brother to having to step back and look at the world a little differently. And you can trace it all in the food. That's the wonderful thing about studying food. It tells you everything.
Mm-hmm. It really does. You know, and in today's world, we have such a dichotomy between fast food and slow food, you know, the sustainable food movement and the McDonald's, Wendy's movement. You know, so many people today don't like to cook, and yet you have so many people who post pictures constantly on Instagram and, you know, what you know, they had for lunch this day or, you know, what they're eating at the restaurant, you know. And it's just really interesting. What's your take on that, everybody posting on Instagram?
You know, I think it's interesting. I started to notice this, you know, maybe in the last decade, not so much Instagram obviously didn't exist, but it's when food and cooking shows started to take over television, basically, and you had more and more. This would have been really starting in the 90s and early in the 2000s. You just had floods of cooking shows on television and people being devoted to them. And it was a time when all you read in the press is nobody cooks, nobody cares about cooking, everybody just wants to eat quickly, get out of the kitchen, and so forth. And yet, you have them riveted to these cooking shows on television. And what I always thought about that phenomenon was that we have a yen to cook. Maybe we're out of the habit. Maybe we didn't pick it up at our mother's knee the way many generations did before us, but there's kind of something in us that wants to make our own food, even if we don't quite recognize that feeling. I think that's what people's addiction to those shows was. And you know what people have always said about these cooking shows on television is that children love them. I don't know, to me that kind of says it all. It's just this instinctive thing. You want to see people up there with their hands in the food. There's something, I don't know, just elemental and delightful about that. So, you know, from there to social media and taking pictures of our food and posting them, it's just another step. We're all just entranced with food. Maybe it comes out visually or artistically or we just want to communicate. We want to brag to our friends about, you know, the restaurant we just went to. But it's the same feeling. We want our hands in the food.
However, do you feel like more people are starting to cook these days? Or do you think, I mean, I still feel like more people are going out to eat and not cooking. You know, even people that I meet who are into the sustainable food movement, they're into, you know, finding what the latest restaurant is and where they can go to get this good food. But they're still not cooking. What's your take on that?
There's certainly more eating out now than, you know, in any previous generation. But I think cooking changes, but I do not think it disappears. I think it rises and falls. When I was at Newsweek, the editors every now and then would say, you know, okay, we need a story about how nobody makes family dinner anymore. Everybody's going out. So I would do the reporting. I'd call the people who do surveys on that kind of thing, people in the food industry, or the women's magazines were always kind of asking their readers those questions. And I would find that family dinner was alive and well. It was different. It was not Norman Rockwell anymore. It was not that, you know, the big family spending an hour at the table and everything made by hand. But it was family members at the table trying to get some time together. The food was a mix of made by hand and, you know, assembled from other ingredients. But it was that everybody was expressing that desire to eat together with their families and to make something, to put their hands out and make something. So I just don't think it's disappeared. At the very time that, you know, the food industry is very busy telling us that people don't want to cook. The food industry has been telling us that since the late 1940s, since the end of World War II. That's what my book, Something from the Oven, was about. It was about how the food industry tried to persuade American women that they hated to cook, that cooking was old-fashioned drudgery, that all they wanted to do was go into the kitchen and start opening boxes. Women resisted that message because it just wasn't true. Gradually, the message really settled in, and you did get less home cooking. But cooking never went away, and I don't think it's gone away even now.
Mm-hmm. Although I think of my my home life, we certainly had family dinners, but my mother, you know, would make regular rice if she had time, but minute rice was certainly in the in the cabinet. Instant mashed potatoes was there. It was all canned vegetables other than iceberg lettuce and the makings for salad. There were no fresh vegetables in our house. You know, we had TV dinners when my parents went out. And we looked forward to that.
Right. But you know what's interesting about
you know,
that?
It really was, you know, as little time spent in the kitchen as possible was kind of like the motto. I think, you know, women's lib, you know, get out of the kitchen, you know, don't do the dishes, you know, make everything super easy. And I think a lot of that has stuck.
Well, there was, in terms of the women's movement, and as I said before, I came right out of that. Yes, there was a thing where don't let cooking run your life. Don't feel that you have to go in the kitchen and turn out some magazine-type fabulous dinner every night and have it own you stuff. It was really liberate yourself from those demands and those standards. But for heaven's sakes, you got to eat, and you should eat nicely. And in fact, the women's movement produced some cookbooks, feminist cookbooks. There was a little trend of that in that period for women who wanted to control their cooking lives, not be controlled by them. And I hope that we've retained some of that over the years since then. It's interesting that you mentioned TV dinners. When they were invented, when they came on the market in the early 1950s, the food industry was certain, or they certainly tried to talk that way, that this was going to replace making dinner. This was the new cooking. You unwrapped the package, you stuck it in the oven, you took it out again, and that was dinner. It didn't happen. What happened with TV dinners was just the way you had them when you were growing up, and I did too. When our parents went out, they pulled out a TV dinner. It was a substitute for cooking. It never became cooking. It never became the real thing. I think we still know what the real thing is. That's why you're seeing cooking lessons, cooking classes, cookbooks. You're seeing those flooding the market, and you have for years people really want to know, and they know the difference between real cooking and not real cooking.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the way you talked about Dorothy Wordsworth, you know, putting all of her energy and her focus and her love into the food that she was cooking for her brother. You know, that's when I talk to groups and talk to them about cooking, I focus a lot. I really think there's something to be said about the love that you can put into food, and that there's an extra, it's an ingredient that you really can't quantify and measure, but nevertheless, I think when you have the love in the food, it really, it comes across. Unlike Eleanor Roosevelt's food. You want to talk a little bit about Eleanor Roosevelt's food?
Sure. No, that's really true, and that is the big difference in the Eleanor Roosevelt story. What I found in studying Eleanor Roosevelt and food was that when she was living in the White House and focused on that job and that kind of view of herself, the First Lady, the food was terrible. She oversaw the worst meals in the history of the White House. And there were a lot of reasons that went into that, but part of it had to do with her very mixed feelings about being married to FDR. You know, many years earlier, he had been unfaithful to her with the woman who had been her social secretary, and she never got over that. He came back, he vowed to give her up, which he didn't, but it was never a real marriage after that. It was a political partnership. Eleanor Roosevelt felt that very strongly, that there was this huge kind of gulf in her life, and the food, in some ways, the terrible food that she accepted in the White House, in some ways represented that. But there was another Eleanor, and there was another feeling about food when she was outside the White House, when she was eating with some of her beloved women friends or other people that she really cared about. Then you see her saying in you know, her column My Day or in a letter, oh, we had the most delicious this. I made popovers. She had a relationship with food that's just so human and full of warmth and love, and it's because that was food with feeling. She had that in her life. You know, if you love Eleanor Roosevelt, and I do, you're just so glad that you didn't miss out on food entirely. She really didn't. She had this other food life that we hear less about, but it was really there.
Uh-huh. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd love to talk about how you think the future of food is going to go with the digital age and that all this documentation on social media. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Laura Shapiro, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
You're listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
This is Rob Simons. Join me Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on my new show called Moving Forward. This show will cover my thoughts about the world and what to do moving forward. These thoughts will venture into environmental issues, United States foreign and domestic policies, putting historical events in context, and current events. So join me on the Progressive Radio Network, on a station that moves forward, and we'll be discussing how we can move forward.
This is Mike Fader. Let me tell you about PRN.FM. It's a whole new world of broadcasting. PRN has absolutely no question the best political and economic shows on the radio. Plus, PRN tops every other station in its health and wellness program.
This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Kayamaniya.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Laura Shapiro, author of a wonderful new book called What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. And right before we took the break, I had asked Laura if we could talk a little bit about the future of culinary history and how you think it will differ with the rise of the digital age and all this documentation on social media.
I'm so glad you brought up that question because I think about it all the time. One of my sort of driving problems in researching this book was finding the material. As I said, I had chosen women who had left a paper trail. They were well known, so their letters and memoirs and biographies about them were there. You could actually do that work. But when you look at those letters, you turn page after page. They say nothing about food. Every now and then there'll be a sentence that goes, you know, had a ham sandwich, and you instantly copy that down, and, you know, that's one little clue.
Right.
But people, as a rule, don't say a whole lot about what they eat when they do this. So you have to really dig deep in the research. Now, of course, it's completely different. As you say, people are documenting every mouthful, every gulp of liquid that they drink, everything they cook, everything they look at in a restaurant. You're going to get a picture of it. So in a way, there's way, way more material. And I often think about historians, you know, years from now, who are going to write this book about people like us and how much easier it will be for them. But then I have to say, will it really be that easier? First of all, who knows if there will be the technology to maintain all this. Libraries even now are trying to figure out how they can archive all this social media, partly because there's such huge quantities of it, and also because, as you know, the technology of your laptop and computers and software, all that changes about every 5 minutes. So things that we thought were so eternal because we had them on floppy disks a few years ago, all that stuff is completely inaccessible now. So that's a problem, obviously, for historians and archivists. But assuming they figure out a way to keep it, what are people going to see? They're going to see beautiful pictures of some, you know, paella, or, you know, my magnificent effort at deep frying a turkey on Thanksgiving. So you're going to see the pictures, but you're going to hear the stories. Are you going to hear about people's mistakes? Are you going to hear about where they got the recipe? All the things that a historian really wants to know. You want the story behind the picture. So my hope is that as people document these things on social media, they'll use words as well as pictures, or they'll use their cameras more widely in the kitchen. Don't just show the finished product. Show everything that went up to it, just so we really have a sense of it. It's 'cause it's not just a pretty picture. It's part of your life. If it's going to talk to us, it has to talk to us about your life, not just the beauty of the final achievement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you definitely have all the stories that revolve around farm to table, but you know, and that's a real social movement now. But you certainly don't have so many of those stories of I grabbed a Big Mac and you know, fed everybody. And yet, that's the real story for so many people as well, because that's the food that they can afford, or that's the food that they have time to eat. And you know, it will be interesting to see. Although we won't be around to see.
Right. But that is, you're raising a really important point. There is no one food story in America. You know, reporters will sometimes say, you know, well, where do we stand with food today? And I have to say, well, who's we? And what's the food? We are a nation of niche markets when it comes to food. These days, it is easier if you live in a decent-sized town or a university town or a suburb, it is easier to find, you know, a lovely farm-raised tomato from not too far away. You can get that, but it's also, as you say, perfectly easy to go to a fast food restaurant that has never seen a fresh tomato. And you'll have people, devoted to both of those ways of life. Sometimes they're in the same family. I mean, we are it's just all a huge array of niche markets. That's what American food is today. It's everything.
Right, it is. Let's talk about a few more of these women, because I found it fascinating. I mean, I did not know Eva Braun at all, who was Hitler's girlfriend or girlfriend, right, or wife.
Yes, no, they were married right at just a couple of days before they both committed suicide. They had a brief wedding ceremony in this bunker far below the Reich Chancellery in Berlin, and not what you call a happy wedding, but it happened. It really must have been one of the most ghoulish events in the lives of all those people. Eva Braun was somebody that I knew a little about, and then when I was kind of looking around for interesting women to include, I read a biography of her, a very substantive, good scholarly biography, and I saw that that it was going to be difficult to gather material about her own relation to food, because there's just very little in her handwriting. We only have a handful of letters and so forth. There's not that much. But you could find the food that was on the table when Hitler sat down to lunch, and then that would have been her meal also. In other words, Hitler's food life is pretty extensively documented. So you were going to find the food. The big question is, what's her relation to it? And I started to sort of put together this view of her as somebody whose relationship to food and everything else was built on fantasy. In fact, she used food to feed that fantasy. She had a view of herself as the beautiful consort of the greatest man in the world. That's what she called him. I am the mistress of the greatest man in the world. That's what she used to say. She called herself the First Lady of the Reich. She changed clothes 6 or 7 times a day so that she was always ready to be on display, looking beautiful. But it was entirely artificial. The fact is, nobody ever saw her. This small entourage of Nazi officials around Hitler, they knew her. The public at large didn't. It was always kept very, very quiet and secret that he had a mistress. He was always seen alone in public, no woman at his side at all. So this whole image that she had of herself as the consort of the great man was entirely kind of invented. And for her, it came to life most powerfully sitting at these lunch and dinner tables with Hitler at Berchtesgaden, which was his mountain retreat where he spent a lot of time. And that was where she could kind of come into her own and sort of swan around as the great lady that she thought of herself as being. So it was this kind of horrifying fantasy inside that little enclosed world. They were a happy Nazi family. They could feast on the rightness of this cause. They could flood their table with laughter and good fellowship and sentiment, because that is what the family table always had been. We were talking about it before, food and love. Food brings us together, food and connection. We all know those themes in food writing. Well, the Nazis knew them too. They could fool themselves that that's what was happening at their table. And it was Eva's presence, I think, that cast this kind of feminine sentimental glow around the table and enabled them to forget or to turn their backs on what was really going on outside that circle, the blood, the devastation, the horror, the chaos. It was on the outside. What was on the inside was the happy family. So that was Eva's relationship to food, and it was a challenge to gather that and think about it and put it on paper for all the reasons you can imagine. She was a horrible person, yeah. And it was a terrifying time. But I think it was a story that deserved to be told.
Right, right. Yeah, no one else was going to tell it, so thank you. and Helen Gurley Brown. The editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan for 32 years. What about her food? I mean, she was always on a diet, no?
Exactly. This is a food story about not eating. She was, you know, she was the dieting queen. But, you know, it was fascinating. She held on to eating as little as possible, to dieting as a kind of sacred thing. That's what made her feel important, because that's what made her feel young, beautiful, and sexy. She truly believed, and she preached this, and she said it from the beginning, you cannot be beautiful and sexy if you are even an ounce overweight. And overweight meant an ounce. I mean, she had no sympathy for anything else. And so she went to incredible extremes until she died at a very respectable old age. She went to incredible extremes to stay thin, to stay what she called sexy. She had plastic surgery. She had the wigs. She had the extraordinary diets that she launched all the time, most of them featuring mountains of chemical sweetener because she had a sweet tooth that she refused to indulge for most of her life. So it was this a really crazy effort to remain 25 years old, sexy and desirable, forever. That was the dream, and it was what she preached in all her work, and it's what the books and the magazines celebrated. It makes a kind of creepy picture, but she worshipped the skinny.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. She actually published a cookbook.
Yes, it was astonishing.
did she ever cook?
It's hard to say. She wrote about cooking, and I think she was probably some kind of home cook, at least in the early years of her marriage. I think that she did cook. She was raised without much money. She had, you know, it's not like they went out all the time. I think that she understood cooking. But she had such an ambivalent relationship with the whole idea of making and serving food. So she would write about being a cook, but she shied away from ever saying exactly what she cooked. And then sometimes she'd say, oh, I'm a terrible cook. I don't cook at all. And then in the next interview, she'd say, oh, well, I love to make pasta. It's one of my favorite things. So she was all over the map when she talked about it. But her publisher had the idea that if she could write a cookbook in the voice and style of Sex and the Single Girl, which was a huge bestseller, then she would be producing another bestseller. So she wrote this 400-page cookbook. She had a professional cook and cookbook writer supply the recipes, but she put them together. She rewrote them so that they were very, very clear instructions, very explicit. And of course, she filled it with all that kind of prose style that she was famous for, the italics and the exclamation points and the addressing the reader, you know, dear and darling and, oh, you're going to love this and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you look at that cookbook, it's actually not bad. She certainly tells you in great detail how to do every single thing, and it's a great swath of food, very elaborate kind of French preparations, and then, you know, take a piece of white bread and spread undiluted canned mushroom soup on it, roll it up and toast it, and you have a lovely hors d'oeuvre. So it's this whole range of our mid-century American cooking that's in there, but, you know, no worse than a lot of cookbooks. It didn't sell. It sold some, but nothing like what she had hoped. And I think it's because she just had no image whatever as a home cook, and nobody was going to really believe that when they went into the kitchen, they wanted Helen Gurley Brown standing there advising them and telling them what to do. You know, they wanted the author of Joy of Cooking. They wanted Betty Crocker. They did not want Helen Gurley Brown.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And then Barbara Vim, what was her story?
Barbara Pym was a wonderful writer. As I say, she published in the 50s and 60s these hilarious, gently satirical, laden with irony, delicious novels about life among women in England, London and Oxford in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they're great, and they're very funny. And they are full of food. And what struck me when I read them from the point of view of food is that you think, okay, post-war Britain, it's Marmite. It is overboiled vegetables. Everything is covered with custard. It is disgusting. That's certainly all you ever hear about the British food of that period.
Mm-hmm.
Not in these books. These women are good cooks. They're making delicious things. They're making the kinds of things that Elizabeth David was going to talk about later in the 50s. But these women are already doing it. So I thought, what is going on? And what's going on? And what was going on was actually the whole range of British cooking. There's plenty of stereotypically terrible British food in these books, but there's also wonderful food. And I think, in fact, that was the story of Britain in those years. There was both, and that's Barbara Pym loved both. She loved that she was living at a time of the worst British cooking and some of the best. I think she loved the Englishness of that great scope. And when I look at some of these lovely meals that came through, I started to think, and I still think, we have to rewrite our history of post-war British cuisine. I don't think it was anywhere near as bad. A lot of it was bad, but it was nowhere near as bad as we all seem to think. And there were certainly some good restaurants around. So
yeah,
that was
really...
Yeah, it
certainly has a reputation, you know, in my mind anyway, as not being the culinary capital of the world. You know, really poor, you know.
Well, we
poor
don't,
food.
And yet, if you read, first of all, if you read Barbara Pym's diaries and letters, which are also full of food, you find a lot of wonderful food there. And then you have to remember that Barbara Pym was not a fantasist at all. Her way of doing research for writing these novels was to sit in a coffee shop or one of these places where she had lunch and watch what other people were eating. And she would go to a nice restaurant and watch. She would go to somebody's house, and she was always writing down the food that she saw. So the record of food that appears in those books, I think, tells us the truth about British cuisine, and it swings from the worst to the loveliest. So mm-hmm. I think it was a much bigger picture than we ever give them credit for.
Right. I bet you're right. And the last one is Rosa Lewis, and we're almost not going to have time. So quickly, just tell us briefly about Rosa Lewis, and then everyone's just going to have to buy the book. So they can...
Right. Rosa Lewis was born a Cockney cook in 18, or she was born in a Cockney working class family in 1867 in Britain. She got herself to learn French cooking, and she used it to climb up the social ladder. She really changed her class, and she used food to get her there. It's a great kind of Eliza Doolittle, My Fair Lady story with some important differences, actually. But you see, what you see there is the intersection of food and class in a really major way.
Mm-hmm. But she was one that really felt like, even though most women were, I mean, most cooks were women, she really felt like men were the French cooks, right?
Yes.
They were the great
women
chefs.
Women were cooking at home, but men were out there in the Escoffier tradition. He was the major cook around at that time. It's men who were making the money, men in the restaurants and hotels, and she wanted to break right into that level, that high-end level of cooking, and she did.
Uh-huh. So what surprised you most in all this research that you did? That you didn't know before? Was there any real surprise there?
You know, I set out looking at the lives of all these women, looking for sort of the mystery at the heart of their life that food would take me to. These are all women about whom other books had been written. I wanted to know, my question to myself was, will food show us something else? And it always did. It always showed me things that I hadn't expected, hadn't seen in the other biographies. So the fact that I was going to find it, that wasn't the surprise. But the surprises were scattered all the way through. I just said Rosa Lewis was a kind of Eliza Doolittle character. That's what I had thought I would see in her life. What surprised me was the big difference between Rosa Lewis and Eliza Doolittle was that Rosa kept her accent. You know, the whole My Fair Lady story is that Eliza Doolittle tried to get rid of her accent. That's what was going to make her a lady in Britain. Rosa Lewis insisted on keeping her accent. She wanted to change class but still be recognized for the person she had been born as. And so that really became her story. And every one of these women had some odd, strange shift of perception that I came across when I did this kind of research. If you look at the food, you see everything.
Fascinating, because I love food, and I'm always interested in what people are eating and how food tells a story. But I never really looked at it, or thought to look at it from the historical perspective that you're writing about. And the book is just so wonderful. And so I really hope everyone listening, you go out there and buy the book. It's really wonderful. Laura, do you want to share your website with people? So if they want to...
My website is laurashapirowriter.com, and you can find how to order the book and also stuff about my other books on there.
Great. And I'll post that on my website, too. So if you didn't write that down, everybody, I will have it on my website. But, Laura, thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. The work you're doing is wonderful. Your books are great. And I really wish you the best of luck.
Thanks very much. It was really fun being here, and I enjoyed our talk.
Thank you. And everyone out there listening, thank you so much for joining me each week. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.